We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all new Bumble with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. We're joined by the author Andrew O'Hagan today, the Booker Prize-nominated novelist and non-fiction writer whose works range from 2020's Mayflies, which was adapted for television by the BBC, to essays and journalism in the London Review of Books and beyond, is here to discuss his latest novel, Caledonian Road. Speaking to Andrew on the podcast is the writer and reviewer, Susie Mazur. You can find her words and interviews, which often focus on the latest book releases, in magazines and papers, including the Sunday Times, the iPaper, Prospect, the Financial Times, and more. Let's join Susie now, speaking with Andrew O'Hagan.
My guest on the podcast today is Andrew O'Hagan, a man who has written 7 novels, 3 non-fiction books, a play, and umpteen pieces of journalism on topics ranging from the origins of cryptocurrency and the Grenfell Tower fire to interviews with the likes of Miuccia Prada and Karl Lagerfeld. His latest book, out now, is Caledonian Road, a novel about class, politics and money that tells the story of London over the course of a year, starting in May 2021. It takes in all the horrors on which modern Britain is built, from the very top to the bottom of society. The action centres around Campbell Flynn, a 52-year-old art historian who was a feted celebrity academic and who trades on his liberal credentials. His blossoming friendship with one of his students, Milo Mangasha, his favourite upsetter, is to be his downfall. But how? Welcome to Intelligence Squared, Andrew.
Good to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking, you know, I've read that you've been working on this novel for 10 years. What first gave you the idea?
You know, sometimes is an actual origin, not only myth, but truth, an origin truth for a big book. And there was in this case, which was that I'd just been through a very eccentric experience, I would call it, working with Julian Assange. I'd been inside that place in Norfolk, the country house where he'd been under house arrest. And then when he moved into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, I was in and out of there quite a bit trying to help him tell his story. But eventually I left that situation, but it had awoken in me a whole series of questions about the relationship between truth and the imagination, between, as it were, news and idealism, political idealism, and also, as it were, personal ambition. You know, Assange had all of those things sort of illuminated in him somehow, I felt. So I happened to be recovering from all that, and I was in the National Gallery in London about 2012, 2013, and I saw this Scottish art historian, I suppose he was, who certainly knew a lot about art, and there was this sort of elegant man standing talking to a group of students, and he was being slightly goaded by one student in particular, a sort of activist-seeming young man about 21 years old, with a backpack, who was incredibly knowledgeable himself and provocative and speaking a different language, actually, in provoking this clearly kind of liberal intellectual with accusations. And the guy was kind of amazed. He clearly had never been accused of anything. He was evidently somebody who was on the right side of history. He was a sort of liberal, you know, pluralistic, open-minded, supporter of many causes. I would have taken that to be the case just by listening to him for 5 minutes. Yet here he was being slightly pushed onto the ropes by a young student, and I thought, wow. They were standing beside a Vermeer, and suddenly a whole vista opened up to me. The story of a Campbell Flynn, an art historian, Scottish, elegant, and in trouble. And partly in trouble because he has this brilliant student, but also because he begins to dismantle his own comfort, dismantle his own life. And so I saw it in front of me, and there began 10 years worth of research and writing.
Wow, that's a great story. How did you decide how big to make it? I think I counted 59 characters in your in your cast list, which was very handy to keep flicking back to. But they take in all sorts, from Russian oligarchs to drill rappers. There's migrant traffickers, crooked peers, a retail tycoon who has embezzled his employees' pensions, right-wing columnists, a queer fashion designer, superstar DJs, and I could go on. But, how did you draw the line?
I think from the very beginning, I understood that this was going to be one of those novels where the connections were deep and surprising between a whole cast of characters in contemporary London. You know, I grew up loving novels like that. I was a great fan of the Dickensian, of the Trollopian, and of George Eliot. Those large canvas novels where sometimes the action was carried and very much changed by minor characters, secondary characters, as they're sometimes called, people who would appear only for a page or two. And that was going to be the kind of book Caledonian Road was, a big entertainment, very much one of those page turners where eventually you would have this series of truths and secrets revealed, and that the reader would be sort of turning the pages to find out what they were. That's how I conceived of it from the beginning.
I love to quote that the late Norman Mailer told you about how to approach your craft, enter your times and write your heart out, which you very much feel like you've done here. Could you just even begin to tell me about the research that you did for this book?
It was an absolutely insane amount of research. I mean, sometimes in one day, I would literally be going from the Old Bailey to meet with a person who was connected to the Russians, oligarchs, to big property developers. Then later in the afternoon, I'd be spending time with members of the British aristocracy. That evening, I'd be with drill rappers in South London. I mean, there was a few costume changes, I have to tell you, in between. It was a sort of pavement pounding experience very often. I clocked up a lot of steps. I clocked up multiple thousands of steps trying to glean the material for what I knew was going to be a big social novel. I just felt it before I'd even fully developed some of the characters. I knew who they were and I went after them. You know, I went to find, the world of superstar DJs, even though I knew that Angus would be a minor character. He'd certainly be a secondary person. He'd come in and out of the novel 4 or 5 times because he had an absolutely defined role in his family and in the plot, but no more than that. And I think that's one of the things you have to face as a novelist, is that there'll be people that the characters like, I mean, that the readers like, but you have to let them go because you could give a whole series of scenes of that particular character in Ibiza. And it would be fun and you could go there. It wouldn't really add anything to this particular plot, though. And again, that's a Dickens problem. You get Miss Flight, who's absolutely memorable and wonderful, coming on for a few scenes. Or Mrs. Jellyby, unforgettable characters, full of their own specific way of viewing the world and their own way of being. But you could unbalance the book if you falsely make them stick around for too long. I think that was certainly my feeling, but the characters grew and grew in relation to each other. That was the thing. When I look at the notebooks now, and many, many of them, and you see this kind of almost organic growth, as if the book had already pre-existed my writing of it. I know that's a weird thing to say, but that's how it felt. That was kind of brass rubbing. It already solidly was there and I just had to find the traces.
You were talking then about Angus, who was Campbell Flynn's son, who was the superstar DJ, just for people who haven't had the chance to read the book yet. Which of those sort of walks of life was hardest to infiltrate?
There were a lot of them that were incredibly sort of closed as worlds for very different reasons. The world of the British aristocracy is incredibly closed. I found that I was sort of, I was invited into that. I went to the Polo at Windsor one initial time and made some connections there that then grew. I was already speaking to a very, very good source who was close to the royal family, who was a duchess, who began to open up those worlds rather kind of amazingly. You know, the language, the habits, the customs, the fears that existed in that world, where there were strange financial connections between minor royals and Russian oligarchs. That became completely explicit to me from one-on-one research. There was a lot of lunches, a lot of suppers, a lot of visits to the grog table in various country houses up and down Britain. And I found that I managed to get much more insight than I would have expected. It was like journalistic research in that sense. I mean, I could have written a piece for the London Review of Books or the New Yorker in the end about the incredible sort of lives of these people and the ways that they had of interconnecting with these financial sources and not thinking it was a moral issue, not thinking it was a problem. Taking a very strong moral line on other parts of British life, these well-to-do people, but not seeing themselves as being in any way answerable for some of the great inequalities that are there in British society today. So I just pursued it as best I can. And I have to tell you, Susie, one of the things that happens as a novelist on a big project over many, many years is you learn to become a kind of wallpaper. You know, this is the nice part where I get to talk to you and we get to open up the question, but actually you don't open up the question while you're working on it. You tend to just become wallpaper. You know, I was in those rooms. I'd make contributions occasionally, but mainly I listened. Mainly I took notes, sometimes very quickly after if I couldn't take notes in the situation. It was the same with the Russians. And that was, these were both difficult worlds to infiltrate, but once they had you in, they kind of run towards a notepad, some of those people. They're quite vain. They love the idea of being memorialized and remembered. And so in a way, after the initial difficulty, that was easier. Much harder for another reason were the gangs. Because the gangs imagine a guy like me, a middle-aged Scottish white guy, as a sort of, you know, drug squad guy, undercover cop. You know, everybody thought I was an undercover cop in that world. I look like an undercover cop to them. I look like a guy from head office who's arrived to, you know, infiltrate their world. And, you know, that's not to say that their entire world is criminal, by the way. It's not. These were artists. These were drill artists. They were often in recording studios, or you would see them, you know, at video shoots, or, you know, I wouldn't at all suggest that they have reason to be worried about, you know, the police constantly, although they clearly do a bit, because there's quite open split smoking, quite a sort of easy attitude to drugs. And of course, there's drug dealing and there's criminality there as well. So it's a bit of both. But they had reasons to really not trust the idea of, you know, interloping novelist coming along asking questions. But, you know, you have to win the trust of people if you're writing the famously called social novel. Then the first thing you require is sociability. Now, it has to be social. That's why I knew that this book would never be set during lockdown, because lockdown, you know, made sociability impossible by its very nature. So I judged the timing over the years. I kept shunting it forward and I had to judge the timing very carefully. And after the second pandemic, so I decided to that May 2021 to 22 would be, that whole year would be my setting.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because it is, you know, it was a book you've been obviously working on for a decade. It could have been written at any time. You wrote another book while you were doing this, plus many other pieces of work, I know and I'm sure. But it very much does sort of rise and fall and hang around the pandemic. I mean, I won't give anything away, but, you know, it's a crucial plot point as well. So, you know,
yes.
How did that help you, or did it hinder you in some ways?
Well, I thought it was going to hinder me entirely. I mean, it loomed before me at a point when I'd already written a lot of the characters and a lot of the scenes were fully formed in my mind. But then I saw that if I had a bit of luck on my side, i.e. there wasn't going to be another full lockdown after May 2021, and if I had that luck, then in fact the pandemic itself, the original pandemic, could be a fulcrum in the book, helping me in a way in my plan to create a large tapestry that, if nothing else, showed up the bright colours around that distinction between rich and poor in this country. For example, I learned pretty early in the pandemic that some of the biggest numbers of fatalities were among Bangladeshi women who were working in garment factories and sweatshops in the Midlands. So again, I got my trainers on, put my jacket on, got on the train and went to Leicester. Went to Spinney Hills, where there's a lot of such factories, and got inside the factories and started to speak to people who were on low wages, who were in quite unsafe environments, certainly unsafe in relation to the COVID threat. They were passing garments to each other, sometimes without any face protection, without enough sanitizer. And the culture around that was very, you know, we've got orders, we've got deadlines, let's go on with it. And those women were among the largest numbers of people dying of COVID in the country. And that's an economic problem. So I allowed, to answer your question, I allowed at that point the pandemic to become a kind of central divider, if you like, between rich and poor in contemporary Britain. I was already thinking about austerity, was already thinking about Brexit, was already thinking about the migrant crisis, and then there was the pandemic. And I knew that these four things together would create this sort of fabric of a sort of utterly memorable historical time in Britain, a time we'll never forget. And I knew that time would require its big novel. That felt like a sort of no-brainer by that point to me.
I mean, we've already mentioned Dickens. You've talked about the sort of Victorian-style social novel. It's impossible not to draw comparisons with Dickens. Which of his novels in particular inspired you, or were you thinking about while you were writing this?
There were two in particular that gave me actual sort of a bit of backup, if you like. I mean, we forget as novelists that we're always relying on each other, much as musicians do. You're always quoting. If you're a pianist, you're always quoting other pianists. You know, your sense of pressure, of pace, of timing, of, you know, volume is all to do with what you've been listening to all your life. As a composer, you may be literally quoting phrases, and there's an influence there. It's kind of delicious in the life of artists. I remember Degas saying somewhere that we were born to look at each other. You know, we are looking machines. And I think that's especially true of painters and novelists, you know, that we spend our lives looking. We take for granted that we have permission to look. Now, I know there's debates out there in the world that would question whether one has permission to look, but in my world and in my head, we certainly do. It goes with the territory. It's the most fundamental part of the job. And one of the things I was looking at, it was certainly mentally, was Dombey and Son, a great novel, one of the biggest, actually, if not the biggest in terms of page numbers, of Dickens's novels, set in Camden Town in the middle of the 19th century, with that great energy that came with the building of the railways. That novel has an enormous family plot in it and a great story of corruption and difficult human relations, as you often find in Dickens. Great comedy too. But what's at the centre of it is the cutting through of those canal-like railway passages through Camden Town. I live near Camden Town. And it meant everything to me, that novel, as I was trying to conceive of a huge cast of characters who would be brought together by a street, in my case, Caledonian Road. In Dombey and Son's case, it's these enormous new mechanical thoroughfares, the railway lines. Also, I was absolutely, you know, betrothed for a while to our mutual friend. Again, a Dickens novel that has a thoroughfare, and the thoroughfare in that book is the River Thames. Every character touches on or floats upon or is found dead in or is otherwise connected to the River Thames in that book. It's an amazing novel which unearths connections between human beings of a sort that you can't even believe. It's so exciting, that book. It sets up language as a kind of servant to the idea that we are all actually living in the world at the same time. We shouldn't forget that. We may be caught up in our own little universe of auto-fictional self-investigation, but actually, the great stories, in my view and in the view of people like Dickens and other Victorians, and certainly, thankfully, a number of my contemporaries today, believe in that notion that it's by looking at each other, by finding common ground, common language, common experience and strangeness and difference among us, that the big novel gets its energy.
And could you just talk a little bit more about Caledonian Road? What does that represent to you as a big thoroughfare of London, and why set it there particularly?
Oh, sure. That's a really important question, I think, Susie, because, you know, the road itself, let me just explain what it is. It's a big thoroughfare, not one of the famous ones like Charing Cross Road or the Strand or Tottenham Court Road. It's It's north. It's right next to King's Cross Station. People who use the Eurostar are on the other side of the station. But on that opposite side, you find a big thoroughfare that was, well populated in the 19th century, called Caledonian Road, named after the Caledonian Asylum that was at the top of that road next to Pentonville Prison, which is also stationed on Caledonian Road. And Caledonian Asylum was the place that the abandoned orphaned children of Scottish soldiers in London would be taken in the 19th century. And there was also a Caledonian market where Scottish farmers would bring their cattle for sale in London. Caledonia, of course, being the old word for Scotland. So being a Scotsman myself, it felt like a gift. You don't often get gifts from the gods as a novelist, but sometimes you do. And I lived in King's Cross for 10 years when I was young and got to know the nooks and crannies of that particular part of London, which were always fascinating. Caledonian Road itself, apart from having these associations that I've spoken about with the prison, with Scottish children, with marketplaces, it was also a place where there was a great multiplicity of economic and social types. That was true in the 19th century, and it's true today. On one side of the road, you have Barnsbury, places like Thornhill Square, where my main character lives in the novel, Campbell Flynn, lives in a big house, which would probably go now for something in the region of £6 or £7 million. He's lived there, as have many inner city Londoners, over a period watching themselves become property rich. And I wanted money to be at the centre of this book. It was one of the sort of, haunting vehicles of change, difference and division that I wanted to be there in the book. And that comes down to property in London. Some of these buildings that sold for under £10,000 in the 1960s are now selling for £7 million. That's just a fact. And so, again, we hadn't had the novels yet, which really showed us that and went inside what that actually meant in a family, in a life, in a community, in a city, when you have people who were, teachers, writers, lawyers, solicitors, accountants who found themselves suddenly millionaires, at least in bricks and mortar. And I wanted to show my readers that on one side of the Caledonian Road, there's that. On the other side of Caledonian Road, there's social housing. There's places where migrant workers are living. There's a whole other London, but only about 300 yards separating them. And so for me as a novelist, that proximity physically, but also the stories that can be, fashioned around those differences, around the fact that some people are sort of unspeakably rich and using the same shops, using the same street, breathing the same oxygen, but otherwise living in another different universe from some migrant workers who are living in a tower block just off the Caledonian Road. So that was the joy of it for me. But I'll tell you something, Susie, which was especially striking about that, is that when I looked at the poverty maps for Caledonian Road and all the adjacent squares and streets of the 1890s, the Booth poverty maps, which used a colour coding to suggest the economic position of the people in the various dwellings, when you laid that map over the present map of Caledonian Road and environment, it was exactly the same economics, exactly the same streets were rich and poor now as had been rich and poor before the advent of the welfare state, before the advent of feminism, of workers' rights, of trade unions. All the things that we take for granted as being cornerstones of our civilization now haven't actually fully changed the economic picture in terms of inequalities in this country. And again, as a storyteller, that's manna from the gods.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
That sort of leads me on to, I wanted to ask, you know, if it's a state of the nation novel, which it sort of very much is, you know, it paints a very bleak picture. Are you that pessimistic about London? Do you feel bleak?
Not at all pessimistic about London. I mean, I live in London and have done for 35 years. It's the most fascinating city in the world, second to none in my view. And I'm a great fan of Paris, Rome, Berlin, New York, and lots of less famous cities. But I have to tell you, for me, London is the one. And I can say that without too much feeling of being party pre, because I don't come from London. You know, I'm an incomer to London, as so many people are. But I do love the place. And I think that the great sort of dimensions of London, this sort of incredible mix that you find here, to say nothing of that great, those great combinations of the classical and the romantic, in terms of its architecture, in terms of the flow of life you find here. I mean, I'm with Dr. Johnson, you know, the person who's tired of London is tired of life. So that's my base feeling. But your question is really about the state of the nation and the state of the capital. And I would say that I'd have to admit that things have taken a pretty bad turn in recent years. I mean, 4 or 5 governments in a row have allowed London to become a kind of modern day version of Casablanca. A place where people with dirty money can come and park their dodgy gleanings without too much trouble. You know, a combination of factors allowed London to become that place. If you look at Tony Blair's deregulation of the city for a start, then you look at Gordon Brown's issuing of golden visas to oligarchs. Then you look at David Cameron's hospitality to the idea of these people and their ways of life and their ways of doing business. And then, of course, Boris Johnson, almost on a more personal level, allowing some of these people right into the heart of the British political system, into the House of Lords and so on. What you see is it's not a party political issue very strictly. Successive governments in this country have allowed this modern-day Casablanca to grow up. Of course, it became a city where if you had dodgy money that wasn't even declared, that's to say that was coming from foreign bank accounts in places like Panama or the Isle of Man, then lots of deluxe property in London was available to buy without too many questions being asked. Hordes of quite dodgy lawyers, very lax accountants, and lots of posh schools. I mean, the oligarchs loved it. They thought they'd arrived in a kind of nirvana, and that's what we allowed to happen here during our lifetimes. So again, a novel was going to try and unwrap that at some point and show the connections that caused it to happen.
You target the sort of cowardice and hypocrisy of the liberal middle classes in the novel. Why that particularly?
I think you've got to be even-handed as a social novelist, Susie. You know, it's okay to sort of name the clearly guilty parties, to look at corrupt royals and sort of tick that box, or look at oligarchs who are clearly sort of laundering dirty money and tick that box. And, you know, certainly I wanted to reveal them and expose them, all the great right-wing conspiracy that exists in relations between a passive media, a right-wing media that somehow finds itself energised by criticising the less well-off or the vulnerable, I would say, but finds it harder to question those institutional inequalities upon which they slightly depend. But at the same time as naming the guilty parties on the right, a novel is not an editorial. A novel does not have a legislative programme. We are not issuing a party political broadcast. I wanted to be even-handed on behalf of the reader. And I have to say that there have been changes and multiple failures on the liberal left as well at the same time. And you'd have to point to that and show how the self-satisfaction that can exist on the left and in the leftist media, the sense that they are above and beyond criticism when it comes to questions about the state of society. Well, that is actually an unhelpful and an unimaginative way of going about thinking about the state we're in, to allow them a free pass, allow me, as it were, a free pass. Some, you know, London Review of Books writing, Guardian writing, guy who's happy to write pieces for The New Yorker and appear on the Radio 4 Today programme. You know, I would be the very person I'm talking about. There's a bit of me in Campbell Flynn. He deserves to be deconstructed for the reader's delight. And I have to take it on the chin that I would be one of the people who had to be self-questioning in all of that, because nobody, when it comes to the state of the nation, really gets off. We've all been part and parcel of allowing this cult of selfishness, even if we congratulate ourselves for being on the, quote, right side of history, as we often do on the left. Did we give up our equity when our houses grew in value? Did we prevent ourselves from sending any of our family or any of our children to private schools? Did we, you know, take up arms against all those causes of inequality? I think you'll find we didn't entirely. And that, I'm afraid, is part of the entertainment here. I mean, you're right when you say it's a pessimistic picture in some respects. That's to say that everybody gets named, and I hope that the evils get called out. But it's fundamentally a comedy. It's a comedy of manners and of differences, you know?
Mm. Well, yes, obviously there are many similarities between you and Campbell Flynn. You were both raised on council estates in Scotland. You've reinvented yourselves as shiny intellectuals. And there's a comment that really struck me by your student upsetter, Milo, who says to his Polish girlfriend, you know, we're all guilty of something. That really, you know, struck me hard, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, what are you guilty of?
I think it's a really useful notion for human beings that, you know, we can spend our lives totting up our virtues and spend our lives, you know, pointing our fingers at the guilty parties who clearly aren't us, you know, but that seems to me a sort of deranged way to go about a kind of moral life, if we can talk about a moral life. People used to talk about the well-lived life, about the ambition that we all had as sort of decent people to live a moral life of some description. And it seems to be not an entirely copper-bottomed version of that life to just find other people to be in the wrong, but you to be pristine. And there's too much of that around at the moment. In the culture, there's a hell of a lot of I'm right and you're wrong. You're not only wrong, but you're insufferable in your wrongness. You know, when you look at the exchanges, those comments that are published underneath articles in newspapers now or on Twitter, it's kind of rabid world of people not just having a disagreement or even having a barney, but, you know, of neutralising each other, of wanting the other not to exist. And I'm afraid that's kind of overripe in the culture at the moment. People are ready to sling each other to the lions on the most flimsy of evidence. And I think there's a hysteria in that I wanted the novel to satirise, you know, that Milo might be, as a 21-year-old, a young man of colour who's pointing up the wrongs of a person like Campbell Flynn, as well as pointing up the wrongs of these dukes and duchesses and embezzlers and so on. I mean, this is a guy who's brilliant on the dark net, young Milo, the man you're calling a disruptor. I mean, our favourite disruptor is he's got a new way of being an activist, a new way of bringing people to book through the dark net and through hacking and so on. That's part of the energy of the story. But even he would admit that he has to be self-questioning. You know, is he motivated by what happened to his mother? I won't give away the plot, but something significant happens to his vulnerable mother in this book. And it's actually one of the things he has in common with his great adversary, the 50-something-year-old intellectual Campbell Flynn, the white man in the big house. They both are suffering from some sense of having suffered a family disappointment, a family disaster or a tragedy to do with parenting and to do with having this energy, I suppose, each of them, to reinvent their lives, to not be over-defined by what happened to their parents. So these are the energies you can, and the patterns that you can set up in a novel. And for me, the joy of writing the book, actually, and the agony, to be quite honest with you, was trying to keep all those plates spinning, all sort of, you know, several hundred of them simultaneously, and then make them all, as it were, all those plates crash to the floor simultaneously towards the end. I mean, that's for me, the great task with a book like this.
You've said before, there are times as a writer when it's more important to create something that causes the reader to search for the explanation in themselves. And again, that sort of really struck me as I finished this and was reading and thinking again about this. It's going to become a TV series, isn't it?
Yeah, this came about from quite early on. You know, people, as soon as I had a finished manuscript, and of course I worked the manuscript for through the drafts, but as soon as I had a decent manuscript, it began to be shown to producers and actors and film companies. And I have to say, it was a very sort of forceful reaction straight away. I mean, I was kind of overwhelmed by how responsive people were to the idea that this big story could become a returning series on television. So American streamers were very interested right away. But there was a particular team led off by a director called Johan Renck, who made Chernobyl, the series for HBO, which I thought was wonderful. I just thought it was humanly and dramatically so brilliant, that piece of work. And he came along with a brilliant producer called Michael Peretz, and they have great experience between them. And they hired very quickly Will Smith, the British showrunner and adapter of the Apple series Slow Horses, and which is a great saga based in London. So it seems to me that this team are second to none, and I've been delighted to work with them so far. Well, I've got every hope and expectation that they're going to do something really exceptional. I certainly hope so.
Will you get involved with the writing?
Yeah, they asked me to, in fact. They said they're setting up a writer's room, and they asked me to come in. And of course, I gave the necessary warnings that I'm the original paper balls across the office, interrupting people, trying to drag people out for a glass of wine at lunchtime guy. And they wouldn't necessarily want me in there. But they said, no, we need somebody like that. And we'd love you to write an episode or two and just be part of the group. So I'm quite excited by that. I love learning new things. I mean, one of the things that's now gone from my life since I stopped researching this book is this business of throwing myself into areas where I was forced to learn things. You know, suddenly being at the Polo at Windsor, or being in the Old Bailey for 24 weeks, or, you know, being with a group of drill rappers, or I was always learning new things for this story. And I'll always do that. I mean, I have a journalistic energy that takes me out. You know, I'm not going to be shy of throwing myself into learning new things for future books. But what's exciting with this is I'm going to hopefully learn something about what it takes to lift something from the pages of a novel onto this much faster moving world of screen images and plot lines going off in all different directions in a returning series.
Do you think, will it get expanded? Because I think I read as well that this was, I mean, it's 650 odd pages, your book, but it was longer. You've cut it back. I think it was 800 pages. I mean, can you bring in more characters and more tangents?
I think that they want to. I mean, I think that they're already looking at the hinterland of some of these characters. They're excited by the potential for this to become a returning season drama, which keeps returning. You know, that a bit like in the, I suppose, if you think of something like The Wire, where it just sort of grew and grew, that minor characters suddenly become major characters, that maybe you do end up going with My main character, the art historian Campbell Flynn's son Angus, is a superstar DJ. Maybe you end up in Ibiza. Maybe you end up on that plane that he's always flying around obnoxiously in. Or, you know, the world of fashion, which is certainly, there are scenes from that world in my book. And I spent a lot of time backstage at Paris and Milan researching that. And I was in the front row, or the second row, or the third row, wherever I could manage to get a seat at many of those fashion shows over a period of years. But there could be more. And I think in television, the adapters will look to sort of grow those worlds out and away from the book. I have no fear about that, by the way. I've loved the conversation I'm having with them. And when they say, oh, we'll take those characters on, what they mean is on from what I conceived. I mean, on and away from what I invented. That's to say, they'll have scenes in life and incidents which have essentially nothing to do with me. And I'm quite excited by that notion. My last book, Mayflies, was adapted for by the BBC, and I loved watching how that grew and changed from being the story that I had invented into being something else, where other creative people got to have their say and put their stamp on it.
Insecurity has been a sort of constant theme in your writing, and that sort of very much comes across in this book. You know, we know that Campbell Flynn is going to lose a lot because you drip feed hints of this throughout the book. I'm not giving away any spoilers. You know, why are you particularly drawn to this notion throughout the pieces you've written, throughout other books and this?
You know, I think it's such a classic area of interest for people who read novels or watch big dramas, is to have this, you know, seemingly successful individual, this tall, elegant man who wears beautiful suits and has a fascinating, brilliant psychotherapist wife. They live in the most amazing house. They have a second house in the country. Their children are both quite high-achieving, contemporary individuals. They have circles of friends and influence all around them. And yet, something is off. Something's not right in the mind and in the heart of Campbell Flynn. Something's beginning to break apart. And the fragmentation of a supposed hero is, I think, a cornerstone of Western drama. It's a cornerstone of the novel. I mean, I say that, but, you know, unashamedly, you know, when I began to conceive of him, a lot of the milieu around him to do with technology, the internet, cryptocurrency, and also these relationships that grew up in the times of culture war. You know, a lot of those themes are very, very new to the novel, but the setup humanly isn't that new. You know, in some senses, you see that in Shakespeare, you know, in the relationship between sort of Gloucester and Edmund in King Lear, or between, you know, Othello and Iago. I mean, there's lots of classics of shapings of this kind of story of how somebody can begin to almost undermine themselves with, is it ambition? Is it self-loathing? Is it the return of something from his past that he doesn't know how to cope with? Is it a development inside his own moral imagination that he'd never be prepared himself for? I think all of these things are happening to Campbell Flynn. He feels he's not as rich as he should be, despite being the man who owns these houses. There's a negotiation with his own ambition and greed at the core of the book. So he writes a silly self-help book that he imagines will make lots and lots of money. What it does instead, we can say, I think, without giving too much away, is to draw him into the centre of an absolutely toxic set of circumstances around men, masculine behaviour, masculine self-description, relationships with women, exploitation. I mean, these things are happening as they do in life simultaneously. I mean, a criticism you could make is that there's so much going on. Maybe there's too much going on. But I would defend that instantly by saying, well, we could see that of our lives. And I sometimes like to think that we can cope with a book which is a little bit like our lives, even to the extent that our lives sometimes give out to little melodramas. You know, poetry and melodrama make for a great novel, or sometimes for a great movie. If you think of some of the movies that have really lasted, stood the test of time. There's something about the marriage of sort of the internal poetic self-examining world and the external world of business and craziness that we're all moving around in at the same time. And that certainly was my hope, is that the busyness of this book would be like the busyness of life, because you don't get to just experience one thing discreetly at a time if you're living a life. You know, it's not that you have the broken love affair but you don't have the problems at work, and you don't have the problems with your children, or you don't have a sort of computer that's breaking, or you don't have to think about who to vote for at the next election, or that you don't have a television program that's sort of brought up something horrible in your mind that you were hoping not to think about. These things are all happening at the same time, and that is where the novel should become, as Henry James once called, a capacious, baggy monster. You know, it can take it all if you set it up and you get the patterns right. I think readers like it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And the other thing that also struck me was how this novel sort of is an amalgam of the work you've done throughout your career, you know, cryptocurrency, on, you know, a lot of the journalistic reporting. And then you've got sort of the ways that you may or may not be similar to Campbell Flynn. It sort of it brings it all together. So I feel you'll probably have to, you know, set out on some new paths now and find some new things to write about.
I think so. The next time you see me, Susie, I'll be a Zen Buddhist sitting in my my cloud, you know, that'll be the day. But no, I think you're right. I'm going to have to sort of throw myself into brand new territory because they covered so much territory, some of which was very new to me. And some of which was utterly familiar and just part of my own life. But, you know, I'm not an art historian, you know, I'm not an expert in Vermeer. My man had to be. And so I found myself, you know, zipping around from city to city all around the world, looking at these Vermeer paintings, becoming a sort of, you know, not an expert, but certainly somebody very familiar with the territory in Dutch art. That's just one example of many hundreds where you do that work for the novel, so that the reader doesn't have to think twice about it. It just so goes down like a glass of cool water after a fever. That's what it should be like reading a good novel, that you just take it in. You're not stopping to think, well, how does he know that? Or why would, you know, is that true about Vermeer? It's you can trust the author because you've gone to the trouble as a novelist to make it right. And I sort of would go further with this particular novel and say that I think I sort of fact-checked this novel. You know, I kind of walked through it in real time and fact-checked it, you know, went to the restaurants and made sure that those things were on the menu. Those things they choose from the wine list and the many expensive restaurants that feature in contemporary London in this novel, that those bottles were actually on the wine list and that they would be priced at the right place for that particular consumer. If it was a Russian oligarch, it would need to be, because they spend, I can tell you from lived experience, they spend ridiculous amounts of money on wine that they don't even finish. It's quite upsetting. Thousands and thousands of pounds on vintage wines in some of those private clubs. So to go to your point, it was fact-checked because it felt to me that the frisson of lived experience, the frisson of actuality, would add to the intelligence of the thing and the experience for the reader of being inside this very plausible world.
Well, novels is the first draft of history and all that. So
I believe it.
And I think that's the beauty of reading this for readers, because it really sort of fills in some of those gaps that you sort of you hear about on the news. And, you know, you want to feel like you're living that. And as you say, it was like a dot-to-dot puzzle for me, sort of like joining the dots, just filling in that picture.
It was nice, you know, when an American writer said the other day, you know, this is like having a backstage pass to London. And I was quite pleased with that, because I know that when I was writing it, that I was getting access to things which, I mean, often by luck, by the way. I mean, it's no great skill of mine. If you can, you know, you can only charm yourself into places so far. But I had luck on my side when I ended up, you know, really knowing those places quite well and was able to bring them home. And that's how I think of it with a big novel. I was bringing it all home. And some of it was very local to me. Indeed, it was my home, Scottish, as I am, as Campbell is, but also having lived in North London and have moved in the media, worked in the media for all these years, it wasn't entirely foreign to me, a lot of the stuff. But some of those gentlemen's clubs and everything, yeah, I ended up sort of absolutely, you know, knowing them. So then, of course, when it hits the news, as it did last week, that the Garrick Club, the awful one that won't let women in, is being challenged now, quite rightly, I could imagine the reactions of the men in those clubs to that hitting the news. I could kind of hear it, that I'd gone beyond being the person who wrote this novel into being somebody who did a crash course that I'd sooner forget now. I need to sort of podge it, you know, get it out of my head somehow.
And do you have any advice for any other writers who want to tackle a State of the Nation novel? I'm thinking much as sort of the mailer advice to you back at the start of your career.
Oh, you know, I'm always nervous about giving advice to other writers because they will, by every right known to man and woman, have their own sense of what to do. But I'll tell you something, if you're going to set out to write a big compendious novel like this, you better be ready to graft. You better be ready to go outside. You better be ready to stick with it. You know, and not, and this is not something you can dream up. And I love the house in Provence over a summer, you know, with a few references to the internet. You know, you're going to have to really pound the pavements. And I think that you only write a book like this if you're lucky as a novelist once or twice in your whole career, because it takes so much out of you to do it. And, you know, the migrant case that forms one of the main strands of the narrative alone caused me to have to go to the Old Bailey every day for months. You know, every one of those discrete individual journeys, you know, across London to get to a court, to get your credentials organised, to go upstairs, to, you know, to sit through the adjournments and the cancelled days. And, it's you know, we don't require any violins around this, but it's a big task. And always I would say to him who's willing to take it on is, please do, because it's the kind of book I like. But I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? But be ready for long nights and long weekends.
Do you think you'll ever write anything so big again?
I think I would try. I would certainly try again. And I've now caught the bug, you see. You know, and those Victorians sort of, you know, were relentless in their willingness to go back to the coalface again. And I'm and all joking aside, I think I'll keep some of that energy with me if I can, and I will return to it. And I can see by the response, I'm pleased to say that this book's having that. I mean, it makes it all feel worth it. I mean, I've just come in from signing huge numbers, copies of this book across London. It's just the way that it's arriving in the culture. I think people were ready for a book like this. That's all I can assume. You know, I mean, you were in early, Susie, reading it and taking an interest in it. And I think that's fantastic because, I mean, you just don't know. I was alone with this for quite a long time. But now I see that, you know, it's literally overwhelming at the moment, the responses to this one. And, you know, I've been around a while. I know the difference. I know books can have different kind of experiences. You know, sometimes they're quieter. Sometimes it's a slow burn. And then if you're lucky, once in a blue moon, it's a sort of instant, you know, and very striking response.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Andrew.
That was a terrific conversation. I loved that.
That was Andrew O'Hagan, author of Caledonian Road, available now in a bookstore near you. I've been Susie Mazzio. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.